Welcome, everyone. Good afternoon. If you could please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. We love all those great ringtones. However, we are recording today's program for KSKA Radio. Thank you to William and Michael for doing the recording. It's this time of year where you can apply for your PFD, and while you are applying online, please consider making a donation to the Alaska World Affairs Council through the Pick, Click, Give program. This is actually the third year of the program, and the process is getting easier every year. Just search for the Alaska World Affairs Council on the list of organizations included in this wonderful program, which gives so much to Alaska's nonprofits. We are a membership organization, so if you are currently not a member, please stop by the front desk and become a member of the World Affairs Council today. At this time, as I see some wonderful students walking in, I'd like to recognize the students present. If you are a student, if you could please stand and be recognized. I guess they're all coming in the back. Welcome. And thank you so much to BP for sponsoring the students. All the lunches are complimentary thanks to BP. I'd also like to bring forward to the podium Brian Davies, who is the chairman of our World Quest competition, a student competition that's happening on February 5th. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. This is yet another pitch aimed at your generosity. Every year we hold this competition for high schools in the Anchorage and Matanuska Valley area. And the winner of that competition, this is a general knowledge, geographic, political, current affairs competition, we send to Washington, D.C. This time it'll be at the end of April, and they take part in the national World Quest competition. Last year, Wasilla High School won the competition and went to Washington and came seventh in the nation. And let me tell you, they are up against some really serious teams, and they did very, very well. So this year, it costs us about $6,000 or $7,000 to buy the airplane tickets and provide the hotel accommodation in Washington for 3 days while they are involved with this competition. And they also are shown around Washington and make use of their time there, go to the museums and everything. It's a really wonderful trip, but it does cost us money. And the way we raise the money for this is by asking people to sponsor a high school team. For the sponsorship of one team of four people, it's $300. And on the table in front of you, there should be a little slip, looks like this, that allows you to sponsor a quarter of a team. $75, or half a team at $150, or a whole team at $300, or a number of teams at multiples of $300. So our only way of raising this money, and we look forward to your generosity in support of what I think is a terrific advertisement for our Alaska high schools. Thank you very much. Oh, and the slips are on the table. If you can't find one on the table, there'll be one at the door. Thank you.
And thank you, Brian, for all the work you do for World Quest. Right now, I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Cheryl Myers, who is the chairman of our membership committee. Besides running her own business and marathons, she is also the president of Downtown Rotary. And to her right, we have Keith Steinbaugh, who will be doing the introduction today. And Keith is the president of our board and makes my job wonderful every day. Keith.
Thanks, Lisa, and welcome everyone today. It's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. Gerhard Kuska. As you can see from the screen here, he's currently the president and CEO of Ocean Strategies, LLC, which is an ocean management consulting firm. Provides strategic advice and services to public, private, academic, and international entities on a broad array of ocean, coastal, and maritime issues. Over the last 27 years, Dr. Kuska has served in a variety of positions, both in the United States, Europe, and the Middle East. These positions touched on ocean, coastal, maritime, transportation, and environment-related issues. And he continues to serve in advisory board capacities around the world. For the last several years, from 2008 until 2010, he advised the ruling family of the Emirate of Abu Dhabi and its government in the United Arab Emirates on ocean and coastal policy issues. He oversaw the development of the Emirates' first ever integrated strategy for its marine and coastal areas, and that's bringing together defense, security, mobility, safety, economic development, and environment and natural resources conservation issues under a new governance structure. Prior to that, from 2006 to 2008, Dr. Kuska served as the Associate Director of the White House Council on Environmental Quality and the Director of Ocean and Coastal Policy in the Executive Office of the President. In this role, he advised the President and the Chairman of the Council on Environmental Quality, and he oversaw the implementation of the President's Ocean Action Plan. From 2004 to 2006, Dr. Kuska worked with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He was a senior policy analyst on ocean policy, intra and interagency coordination, and strategic planning. From 2002 to 2004, he served on the staff of the presidentially appointed U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy, where he advised the commissioners and staff on ocean governance issues and contributed to the drafting of the commission's landmark report. Prior to 2002, Dr. Kuska worked with two U.S. senators. He also advised the United Nations, conducted research in academia, and served as a senior executive with several global corporations in the ocean and air cargo logistics industries. He did his undergraduate work at the University of Delaware and the University of Augsburg in Germany, and he received his PhD in marine studies from the University of Delaware, where he conducted research on federal interagency collaboration within the ocean policy arena. He's here today to speak to us on marine and coastal management in Abu Dhabi towards sustainable diversification. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Kuska to our podium today.
Thank you very much for that very nice welcome and introduction. Thanks to all of you for coming here to listen to me talk a little bit about something that I'm very interested in. I have been changed my career to do this, and I've had some interesting opportunities, most recently in the Middle East. And some folks, if they're wondering why am I here, you may have heard this said many times: "May you live in interesting times." It's attributed to a Chinese proverb, but actually no one really knows where it came from. There's no real Chinese equivalent. It's supposed to be a curse, actually, not a blessing. And if you think about what we've been through in recent times, the economy, the economic downturn, some of the environmental issues we've had to deal with, the Gulf of Mexico oil spill and the impacts that's had on oil and gas development around the country. We've also, over the last 10 or 12 years, had a lot of developments in ocean and coastal policy. Beginning at the end of the Clinton administration, there was a big conference on ocean, National Ocean Policy, or National Ocean Conference, in Monterey, California. After that, the a ocean commission was founded. Our congressman here, Don Young, I know at the time was skeptical whether that would even make it, but it did get created. Ed Rasmussen, a well-known Alaskan and philanthropist, was a member of that, and I got a chance to work with him on that. They came out with almost a doorstopper of a report that really looked at the last 30 years or so, at the time, last 30, 35 years of ocean policy, and came out with a series of recommendations. And now we have two different administrations trying to implement those. First, it was the Bush administration, where I had the chance to work after leaving the Ocean Commission. And now the Obama administration has taken a different take on it. And so I'd like to talk a little bit about that today and what some of the opportunities, I think, are for Alaska and maybe some of the risks as well. And, you know, at the end of the day, I kind of like talking about Abu Dhabi, too, so I thought it was a nice idea to put all this together. So in the next, 20, 25 minutes or so, I'd like to give you a little bit what I call Abu Dhabi 101. Some of you may be familiar with Abu Dhabi. Some of you may have heard of Dubai, the cousins up the road, if you will. a little bit my connection and experience, what I did there, some of the lessons I think they'll be useful for us in the U.S., and particularly in Alaska. You might say, well, gee, what do they have to do with us? There's actually quite a lot of similarities, beginning on a cultural side, a very different culture, but I think very similar goals, economically, very similar as well in certain ways. And then come back to the U.S. here, talk about what has happened in the last year or two with the Obama administration, the national ocean policy there they've issued, and what that means for Alaska, and some thoughts without wanting to tell Alaska what to do, because Alaska has enough people from out east and from the lower 48 trying to tell them what to do, but maybe some thoughts, some things to get people thinking about what Alaska might want to do to take advantage of some opportunities. Getting right into it, Abu Dhabi is, it's actually pronounced Abu Dhabi, Abu from father, Dhabi is a type of deer or gazelle. The name, hence father of the gazelle, you can see on the left of the screen the relative position of the United Arab Emirates. Abu Dhabi is the largest emirate and also the capital of the United Arab Emirates. On the sort of northeast tip of the Arabian Peninsula, surrounded by Oman, Saudi Arabia, and across the Gulf from Iran, there's a bit of a sort of political posturing going on with what we name that body of water. Most of the world calls it the Persian Gulf, and the Iranians like to call it the Persian Gulf, but all the Gulf Arab states call it the Arabian Gulf, and so there's arguments about what the official name of that is, and it depends really where you come from. If you look to the right of the screen, you'll see the makeup of the UAE. It's a relatively small nation, made up of seven emirates, or small sort of type nation states. It was founded in 1971, and I'll tell you a little bit more about the founder in just a second, but you can see Abu Dhabi makes up the majority of the land area and the water area. In terms of resources, oil and gas comes to mind, as most of you probably know. The UAE holds about 9% of the world's proven reserves. That's about 98.2 billion barrels of oil. They have about 5% of the world's natural gas, about 5.8 trillion cubic meters. Abu Dhabi holds 95% of the oil and 92% of the gas. So they're really the powerhouse. They're the ones that call the shots. And if you hear about Dubai in the news, it's because Dubai didn't have the oil resources that Abu Dhabi did and realized they had to diversify and develop the brand Dubai and did a lot of interesting developments. You've probably seen pictures of the tallest building in the world there. You've seen pictures probably in stories about palm islands, artificial islands out into the Gulf at a scale as yet having never been done before. And Abu Dhabi had the luxury of being sort of the big brother that could survive on its own resources. But I think through the change in leadership, they've realized that there is a need to diversify. One day the oil will not be there, and they've created a wonderful environment for their people and for those that live there. But to sustain that over time, they're going to need to look at other things besides oil and gas. The climate is slightly different than Alaska. Summers anywhere up to about 120, 125 degrees, and in Abu Dhabi with a humidity of 90 to 95%, so it's not someplace you want to go out during the day or at night. I thought it might be nice at night to sit outside, but when the lows at night are 95 degrees and 95% humidity, it doesn't make for pleasant evenings out on the veranda. Wintertime starts sometime in around November or so, November, December, and they're very pleasant. Temperatures from 55 degrees to about 80 degrees, relatively dry. You get a lot of sun there, very little rain, and that has an impact also on water usage and electricity. Just briefly to the leadership, the gentleman in the middle, Sheikh Zayed, is known as the father of the nation, a remarkable man who, through a peaceful coup in the 1960s, took over from his older brother, Sheikh Shakput. His older brother was somewhat more conservative and didn't feel that developing Abu Dhabi's oil and gas resources were necessary. Sheikh Zayed saw the opportunity to take that and turn that into turn Abu Dhabi and eventually the UAE into a modern state that it is today, and create a better life ultimately for the people that were living in desert dwellings and under in the harsh elements as late as 40 years ago. So he has 19 sons. Or had 19 sons. He passed away in 2004. You can see a picture at the bottom The only picture known where he had all his sons, I imagine family portraits there would be difficult to get everyone together. He had many daughters. They don't often talk about the daughters, but he had 19 sons, the two most prominent of which are pictured above with him. And you see these three pictures next to each other all over Abu Dhabi, like we might see the president and vice president in federal buildings here or buildings around the state or the governor and lieutenant governor around the state. You see these pictures everywhere, in the smallest little shops to the biggest government buildings. The gentleman to the left is Sheikh Khalifa, his oldest son, born in the late 1940s. He has been groomed to be the next ruler since he was a young boy. But he is not really the day-to-day ruler, effective ruler of Abu Dhabi. That's the gentleman to the right, Sheikh Mohammed, the crown prince. He's the gentleman who comes to the United States, meets with our president, travels elsewhere, and he runs Abu Dhabi on a day-to-day basis, and out of deference, of course, coordinates these things with his brother, but he is the true power base in Abu Dhabi. Born in 1961, highly educated, a great diplomat, a very intelligent man, very easy to work with, and does quite a lot, sleeps only about 3 or 4 hours a night, and still has the energy to keep a full-time active schedule. He himself has several children, has only one wife, whereas some others, including Sheikh Zayed, had four wives, as they generally can take up to four wives if they wish and if that works out for them financially. Let me move a little bit into managing what they do in managing their coastal and marine areas. Now, I found they were already very forward-thinking. They had a very developed environmental program. They were looking at environmental conservation already during the time of Sheikh Zayed. A very harsh climate, obviously, with those temperatures, the Gulf being very shallow and very salty, with desalination, a lot of the brine, the excess from creating the drinking water is dumped back into the Gulf. And so it's a very salty environment. It's a very warm environment with temperatures getting close into the 90s, the water temperatures in the Arabian Gulf getting into the 90s in the summer. So it's a difficult environment for marine life to exist. All of Abu Dhabi's waters are oil and gas concession areas since the 1960s. And so whenever they want to do something, a management action, there needs to be some sort of coordination because there can be significant financial consequences for the emirate and for the country by taking actions in areas that have already been promised through a concession to a private company, a private oil company or exploration company. So the Crown Prince realized that he needed to do something about maritime security. Iran has the tensions with Iran over some islands that are disputed between the two countries, as well as some incursions into Abu Dhabi waters. There was a sense that there needed to be an enhanced maritime security approach. At the same time, terrorism has, since 9/11, has obviously been on everyone's mind, and Abu Dhabi and the UAE in general had been for a while a funnel in terms of money and weapons for terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. Abu Dhabi, and I should say the United Arab Emirates, is one of our, if not our, the most closest ally the U.S. has in the region there. And they are very much on the same page in terms of halting terrorism, financing, transfer of weapons. And so they've cracked down on the financing. There's no more money going through that is a very close cooperation between the UAE and the United States and our allies. And the transshipments that were happening through the UAE have also stopped. The result is that Al-Qaeda doesn't think that the UAE is a very friendly place anymore, and that creates an increased risk of terrorism in the country. So with that in mind, the Crown Prince said we need to have a maritime strategy, but we're also looking at diversifying our economy. We need to worry about the environment, obviously, which is fragile to begin with, and the impacts that could have on tourism. So I think we need to look at something more broadly than and bring these things in under one umbrella, if you will. So he decided that he was going to look at defense, security, mobility, safety, economic development, and environment and conservation sort of at one time. And they wanted to do something slightly different. If you have watched what has happened in Dubai, they've had very quick development. For those of you that were in Dubai 10 years ago, you wouldn't recognize it today. They've built into the desert. The distances between Dubai and Sharjah have disappeared. You just seamlessly go from one emirate into the other. The growth has been tremendous. There are statistics, I've not counted the number of cranes myself, but there are statistics that say that a quarter of the world's large cranes are in Dubai. I don't know if that's true, but if you drive around there, you will notice that there are thousands of cranes in Dubai and in Abu Dhabi as well. So despite the downturn in Dubai, they have continued to develop, and Abu Dhabi has watched this and decided, well, we want to be careful because Dubai has had some problems, water quality, they've had some hydrology issues, they've built these large palm islands and found that the water flow wasn't what they'd expected, had to cut channels in. There's been collection of debris, water quality issues, and infrastructure on land as well by developing too quickly. So Abu Dhabi wanted to do things differently, and so they decided we need to bring all this together. This is where I came into the picture. I had excuse the formatting. I think because of my background, having worked to bring groups together, to bring people together, to bring agencies together with other stakeholders, develop these sorts of strategies over time, through time in Congress, through time with the federal government, working as a consultant in academia and in the private sector. They'd asked me to come serve as a senior advisor and develop this. And basically it was, here you go, make it happen. And the charge was basically to develop something of a bottom-up process, something that hadn't been done before, because generally direction is given there from the top. Generally, direction is given there from the top, and decisions tend to go uphill until someone actually makes a decision. So there was a need to bring together the different agencies, the different players in these different sectors, come up with some priorities so that the Emirate is able to actually decide where can we develop, how can we develop. Oil and gas will continue. We want to take care of the environment. We want to make sure that we can diversify in tourism, in industry, in manufacturing. And so we had these lists of things that we needed to do. Now, I'd been to Abu Dhabi in the 90s, and I remembered the sleepy town I told you about before. And so when I arrived in the middle end of 2008, I was welcomed by this site. You'll note on the far left is a picture of a mosque, the Sheikh Zayed Mosque. It's now the third largest mosque in the world. It could have been the first, I suppose, but that might have been politically incorrect and impolite to the Saudis, who have the first, the largest, and second largest in Mecca and Medina. But don't worry, there are some largest in there. They have the largest carpet in the world, single carpet. I'm not sure how they transported it, but it is one piece, and it is very, very, very long. They also have the largest chandelier in the world at about 9.5 tons, and I hope it's the strongest cable in the world. You'll note above that the Leaning Tower of Pisa-esque type building called Capitol Gate that just was recently finished. It leans about 5 times more than the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and on purpose. To the right, the HQ is called. It's a disc-shaped building that a large developer, Aldar, uses as its headquarters, very close to where I lived. The bottom left, you'll see the Yas Hotel, which is the only hotel in the world situated right on top of a Formula One racetrack. So, between the red part and the blue part, those are LED screens that change color. So during the night as you're driving down, it might be blue, it might be yellow, it might be any number of colors. They just change them. But underneath that, there's a bit of a bridge with a bar and some other facilities there. And the cars actually drive under there. So it's not a really good time. If you want peace and quiet, it's not a good time to stay in the hotel when the Formula One's in town. Right next to that, and next to the Formula One track, you see a red sort of spider-looking building. That's Ferrari World. That's the largest indoor theme park in the world. It just opened this November. It also holds the fastest roller coaster in the world. It gets you up to about 3 Gs. Not for pregnant women and children, I guess. And to the right, the last one I'll show you today is the Emirates Palace. It's probably the most recognizable one. It's been in movies. It was originally created by Sheikh Khalifa, the ruler, as a place for the GCC rulers, the Gulf Cooperation Council, to meet when they got together and when he hosted them. They each have their own residence, if you will, in that hotel. The hotel's rumored to have cost somewhere between $6 and $8 billion. I don't know, but it's quite something to see. externally as well, they have big plans. You'll see green all over the place. If you've ever been to the Middle East, you know that a lot of the places are suffering from water shortages, and so any type of plant life, any bushes, any trees, any grass, needs its own water source. So everything you see that's green there has its own water source, meaning there's an irrigation system that is put there, and it's constantly being watered. To the right, a very ambitious project, Saadiyat Island, translates to Island of Happiness. The beach along the left side is going to have 9 5-star hotels. On the front here at the corner, you'll see the beginning of what one could call a museum row. There are going to be 5 world-class museums. The first one is the Guggenheim Museum. The next one is the Louvre, the first one outside Paris. Then we have a performing arts center that looks like a huge science fiction tadpole. And then a maritime museum, and then there's a national museum honoring Sheikh Zayed. A huge marina that holds hundreds of boats, residences, golf courses, tremendous developments. I couldn't help putting in a picture of the camel races, but because you notice that there's an interest, a very strong desire to maintain cultural heritage. Only about 15% of the 6 million people that live in the United Arab Emirates are actually locals, actually national Emirati Arabs. The rest of the people are expats, people that have come from all over the world, from South Asia, India, Pakistan, Philippines, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. They do a lot of the hard work. Then there's folks from the from Europe, from the US, from South Africa, from Australia, and other places that serve as technical advisors, engineers, doctors, and help to build capacity among Emirati nationals. But there are still these sorts of interesting events on the side of all this modernity. And I love the camel race because these poor guys here you see right there on the left, they're actually holding the camels. I don't know why the camels can't stand there themselves, but the practice is they hold the camels and then somebody says go, that thing goes up and the camels charge at those poor guys and start the race. And so they've got to get out of the way. And inevitably, always someone gets trampled. And so it's quite amusing to watch. They don't use jockeys anymore because there were issues of with children being used imported from Asia to be jockeys because they were small and light. So they have these little sorts of robots, and the robot has a speaker in it so that the owner can yell at the camel to go faster, and it has a little whipping arm there, you see, and he just presses his button and it whips faster and faster to get the camel running. You can see the jockeys there after a race. They're all pretty tired and taking a break. But what happens is the owners, it's quite a large track, the owners will be outside the track in their SUVs, and there'll be a driver and the owner will be sitting in the passenger seat, and they try to keep up with their camel. So there's a sort of a race going outside, the race of SUVs, and not someplace, not a track you want to be on while the race is going on. You know, they have all the same sorts of things. You know, people said, what are you going to eat when you go there? I mean, everything you find here, you find there as well, and then some, because everything is imported. So if you want Burger King or Starbucks or anything like that, Baskin-Robbins ice cream, it's all there. You can get it. And then they have some things that we wouldn't have here, like on the right here. Those are gold vending machines. So if you happen to be short of gold coins, you can go to a couple places and just step up with your credit card and buy some gold coins. I'm not sure why you'd want to do that, but it's there if you want it. I saw some great opportunities there. I mean, the challenges I'd seen in the federal government in working with our system, as great as our system is, and our system does a couple things. It can stop bad things from happening. It can also stop good things from happening. What I saw over there was, well, we've got somebody at a very high level that's interested to do something meaningful. He's got clear goals. He's got a clear purpose. We don't have a Congress. We don't have external influences, really. He says, do it. It happens. And we didn't really have to worry about money. So I thought, this is going to be great. What I didn't take into account were some of the difficulties that I wasn't aware of. The business culture is very different. Despite education and despite exposure to the Western world, they still do things their way. And a lot of that is based on tradition Bedouin culture. Things are discussed for a long time. There's avoidance of sort of open provocation and open conflict. So very often when you have, as a Westerner, you come into a situation there, you're negotiating, you kind of like to know if It's a yes or a no at some point. And very often, the tendency to avoid conflict results in them saying, well, God willing, it'll happen. So you get a lot of God willings, and you say, are we okay? God willing. Are you going to do this for me? God willing. And oftentimes, that's an excuse for no, or a substitute for no. And you don't know that till you get some time down the road, and it can be very frustrating if you're not used to it, and if you can't just sort of roll with the punches, if you will. I put a picture here of something called a majlis. It's a traditional sort of sitting room, and most Emirati families have some variation of this in their home. When guests come over, generally it would be men that came to visit. They would sit in this room, and they would talk, smoke, drink coffee, whatever, for a couple of hours. This is also the way that business was done in Bedouin culture. People would come to the sheikh or chief with their grievances, and they'd get them resolved as if they were going to a judge. That practice is still followed today. The ruler and other members of the royal family will hold weekly, sometimes majlises, where anyone can come and tell them about any issue, including that their camel got run over or that they're having problems with their family, and they'll get advice or some solution from the benevolent ruler. Communication is challenging. The main language is Arabic. Everyone speaks English. But miscommunication and misunderstandings happen all the time, particularly when you think someone understands you and they don't want to tell you that they didn't understand you because they want to save face or don't want to make you feel bad. They also, when I got there, they liked to communicate with letters, which I thought was a nice way to do that. We hardly write anymore. We all use email. We all use all kinds of different forms of communication. And they liked the official letter. But when I arrived, I had a very, very tight deadline that was made tighter, and they wanted to use letters to communicate that we needed to have meetings, and these things would be delivered by courier. And I thought, well, this will take us 3 years, not the amount of time that His Highness wanted us to do. And I wrote at the bottom there, sort of, you want it when. I should talk about that first. I arrived in August, and about on the third day, we had a briefing with his Highness, the Crown Prince, in the Sea Palace. One of the many palaces they have, very ornate, very beautiful. And we gave a presentation. He then thanked us, stood up, and gave a very impassioned 30-minute extemporaneous speech, which I'm not used to from heads of states. Generally, they have prepared remarks in front of them or teleprompters. And he stood up and just sort of off the cuff gave a very impassioned speech about why this was important and how he expected all his cabinet members to follow suit. He then shortened the timeline. I was there 3 days, and now instead of having a year, we had about 4 months to do it. And so that made it harder when you're using sort of very basic forms of communication, like letters instead of emails and phone calls, because people are worried about this is the way we always do it. Capacity and capability development. There is a program in the Emirates called Emiratization, or a movement, to try to build capacity among nationals. And what that entails is basically giving them the experience, putting them in the positions to be able to run the country on their own. And eventually, that should be in our interest as expats to help them run their own country their way. We give them advice. They choose to listen to it or not. If they don't listen to it, we try to help them make the best out of what they actually ultimately end up doing. It's a slow process, though. And although they get educated many of them are getting educated in universities in the U.S., in prestigious universities, whether it's Harvard, Yale, places like that, these things take years to develop. And so these are challenges that we have to face. Is that right? Yes. So I won't read you this slide, but I will go through it so those of you in the back that can't see it. So let me summarize. We actually did what we needed to do. We had developed the structure. We got a strategy completed. The Crown Prince signed off on it. He was pleased with it. It dealt with all the areas that we had talked about. It allowed for oversight and coordination through this new governance structure that began to manage it, and the agencies were off doing what they needed to do by the time I was leaving 2 years later. I highlight three points here. Resources and economy will be developed. There was no concern that was ever not going to be the case. That's the lifeblood of the country, and that is how they wanted to proceed. And I think those are things that we need to consider here, in the U.S. and Alaska. The environment will be conserved for present and future generations. Well, we do that here as well. And I think what we need to get better at doing is balancing. We don't need to go one way or the other. I mean, we don't know, I don't think anyone wants to damage the environment for the future. At the same time, we want to make sure that we are using our resources in a sustainable way. And safety and security. I mean, we can ensure that that's also taken into consideration. These are the things that actually came out of this process. However, some of the things that I caution, and I think they're lessons for us in the U.S. That we noticed there, is there's always a tendency to want to build new structures. And that's what I call structural creep. We have a problem, it's not being addressed adequately for whatever reason, and so we create a new structure. We create a new body and say, now they're going to work on it. And so we have this blossoming of new bodies and new structures, and the poor people that have to manage these things and run them in the government, and the people that have to spend time and resources to go to these groups, sometimes don't even know why they're doing these things. Appropriate growth. I'm not just talking about development. I'm also talking about trying not to bite off more than we can chew. What I mean by that is, oftentimes, there are many things we want to do, and I think we've seen. We've experienced that over the last couple of years. We may want to take care of healthcare, we may want to take care of defense, we may want to take care of the environment, we may want to take care of the economy, all sorts of things, but we need to prioritize and make sure that we don't take on too much at the same time. And so I would advocate, and we noticed there, Dubai had these challenges, and Abu Dhabi decided we need to focus on what the biggest priorities are, take care of those first, and then move on from there. Model application. This has nothing to do with applying to be a model. This actually has to do with models. When I talk about models, are the things that constructs that we use to help others manage. And so we use the U.S. model as a base, what we'd done in the United States, and tried to take that over there. And we learned very quickly that they weren't too keen on using our model because we're very different. And I think Alaska has similar issues. When the federal government sometimes develops things in Washington, D.C. that may work well in Florida or may work well in New England, but may not be right for Alaska. And that's something we saw there as well. Capacity building and turnover, clearly, these are things that you see again and again. If you don't have the right people in the right place doing the right job, if you have constant turnover, these are things that hold us up. And I just put last, you can balance. There are forces going in both ways, but it is possible, and I've seen it done. You can balance development and conservation. It just takes work, and there needs to be a focus on it. I've just put here, and I don't want to make this a grad school class here, but I've put six things that I've been able to summarize my experiences both in the U.S. and in Abu Dhabi, and I think these six things. You need to have a purpose, a clear purpose. You need to know why you're doing these things, and there need to be benefits. I mean, Alaska is not going to engage, or shouldn't engage. I would advocate if it doesn't seem to make sense for the state. Leadership. That leadership can be at any level. That can be the governor. That can be people in the community. That can be people in this room that are passionate about the issues that want to lead and see something through to the end. Membership. I don't know how many times I've been to meetings or been part of programs and very important initiatives and found that people that have no idea about what's going on or not the appropriate level are being sent to these things. And that's just dooming it from the beginning. There's a lot of experts here in Alaska. There's a lot of experts all around the country. And there shouldn't be any reason for not putting the right people to these tasks. Structure. This is the reason, actually, most often next to funding, that gets blamed for things not working, which is why we see this structural creep. We just build a new one. We love boxes. If you've ever been in a meeting where we're going to talk about strategy, everyone loves boxes, and then we'll put this one up top here, and this one under here, and this one over here, and then we're going to have the advisory committee here, and then here, and then we just let it go, and don't do it, and assume everything's solved oftentimes, and it doesn't actually get solved, because there's other things in play. I'm not suggesting the structure's not important at all. It just needs to be the right size. More is not better. Simple processes to communicate are good enough. Sometimes we need something more permanent. It really depends on the problem we're trying to do. I've seen that in Abu Dhabi, and I think that'll be the case here in Alaska as well. external influences, you know, we need to use our resources, whether it's our congressmen, our senators, people in the community, industry, associations, we use them to our advantage and be careful of political jockeying. And funding. And funding doesn't mean that we always need more. I mean, obviously we all want more. But it really talks about using our resources responsibly and pointing them at the most important issues. So meanwhile, back in the U.S., excuse the formatting again here, we saw a different approach. The Obama administration put together an interagency ocean policy task force to review ocean policy as it had been implemented in the Bush administration, to look at the Ocean Commission recommendations again and decide how to move forward. They came out with an executive order. I'll call it a new way of implementing the U.S. Commission on Ocean Policy recommendations. A lot of similarities, but some differences. The National Ocean Policy is a statement that it's a series of principles. It talks about balancing. It talks about using various approaches. I personally don't have a big problem with it. I think it's the devil's in the detail, how these things are implemented, what they mean at the end of the day for Alaska. That's the important thing. The governance structure is very similar. It has a different name, but it's very similar to the governance structure that was there before. And again, structures are only as good as the people and the issues and the things we're doing with them. And this last thing, coastal and marine spatial planning, which has caught a lot of people's attention, and they're really concerned. A lot of people are calling it ocean zoning. They're concerned that we're going to be doing things in the ocean that we're also doing on land, that it's going to reach into state waters. It's going to impact how Alaska does its business. And first of all, these concepts aren't new. They've been around for, you know, at least 20 years in different forms: integrated coastal and ocean management, ecosystem-based approaches to management. These all have elements that are similar. But there's been some messaging issues. I mean, there's two issues here. There's process issues and there's some substantive issues. Process-wise, I've been to a half dozen meetings and heard different messages from different speakers about what this means. Now, the federal government, when I talk to them, will tell me that they are concerned about creating stability, predictability, getting rid of waste, making sure that we're communicating better so that we can take advantage of opportunities and create an environment that is sustainable, that allows us to develop and allows us to conserve. For some reason, that's not coming across because the messengers are delivering different messages. I've heard messages that said we're going to conserve more than we're going to develop, even though the bullet on the screen said something completely different. And so that's causing industry, that's causing states to be apprehensive. And that's the message I'm getting traveling around the country, talking to different people, is that folks, there may be the right intentions behind this, but the message is not being delivered properly. The second thing, concerns for some I wrote here, including Alaska, there is a bit of a difference in the approach on coastal marine spatial planning. They're talking about regionally managing, which makes some sense. I mean, we don't want to manage the same things in Alaska the same way we do in Florida. But in the last administration, the approach was if a state is interested in working with the federal government, if a state has some priorities that they want to work on, then the federal government will come together and work with that state. And so, for example, in the Gulf, the five states got together. Governor Perry from Texas, Governor Haley Barbour, and the other governors got together. They picked issues that were important to them. We marshaled the federal agencies to sit with them and say, okay, work on those problems. And so some agencies like EPA and NOAA, they adjusted their budgets regionally to work on those issues that were important to the states. That was a good advantage, a big advantage to the states. If a state didn't choose to work on it, for example, Alaska didn't choose a large approach like that, federal government said, fine. We'll try to make sure that we communicate on the areas, whether it's fisheries through the councils or other avenues. We'll make sure that we're communicating, and if and when you want to move forward with something more, we're ready to do so. This approach is slightly different in that it's saying that there are going to be nine councils, nine areas, and they will be developed. The federal government will move forward. They'd like states to come along, but whether states come along or not, the federal government is going to move forward. Alaska has been, I think, a bit apprehensive. And I understand the concerns here, I think, particularly because it's difficult to judge what something's going to do for you if it hasn't been created yet. There's a lot of discussion about what a mechanism might do or what this regional planning might do, but it's unclear. Are Alaska's, can we deal with Alaska's issues With existing mechanisms? I don't know. So the question I ask here, and this is my last slide. Is this going to work for Alaska? Well, let's talk about what it means to work. I think clearly Alaska has to see some benefit here. If Alaska doesn't see a benefit, I don't see why Alaska would want to engage in this process. That said, though, I put some caveats there. If it's going to work, first of all, it's got to be driven by state, tribal, local needs. That's got to be first and foremost. It can't be something that's been worked somewhere else and we're going to try this here. It needs to be based on the things that are most important to Alaska. First of all, not taking on too much. Again, I think focusing on the things that are most important. There are a lot of things that are important in Alaska right now. Whatever those highest priority issues are, and I could pick some, but I think that'd be unfair because I'm not from Alaska. Focusing equally on development, use, and conservation. You know, this document that came out that I showed you before, a picture of the final recommendations of the task force, it went out as an interim report, and there was an opportunity for folks to comment. And those comments came in, and they dealt with those comments, built them in as they could. And if they couldn't, they tried to explain why they didn't. And so one of the comments that came by, and I don't know if it came from Alaska or someone else, was that it seems like there's more weight on protection and conservation than there is on development. And we think that should be balanced. And the response, I think, that came back that's listed in that public document is that, you know, the president said in his memo in 2009 that we should focus on, you know, more on conservation. And so that's what we're doing. And so I think it's going to be important to rebalance that, particularly in Alaska, where resources are plentiful. There's an interest and a need to develop these resources for Alaska, for the country, for the world. And so Alaska, you know, Alaska has a very strong position, has a great record of managing resources sustainably. If I just use the fisheries as an example, there are no overfished species here, whereas the rest of the country is in parts quite troubled with their fisheries. So Alaska has a good record, a good history. Again, avoiding the one-size-fits-all. I know that there's always an interest to try to standardize these things because it's easier to manage them. It's easier to try to judge progress when you compare apples to apples. But unfortunately, our country is just too different, too diverse, and we need to look at, you know, maybe there'll be something small in one area, and maybe there'll be something more broad. Maybe there'll be two issues in the Southeast Atlantic. Maybe there'll be three or five in Alaska. We can't really compare those. It's difficult, and I don't think we should. I talk about focusing on the pillars, but I think actually if you conceptually really make sure that you're focusing on purpose, leadership, membership, structure, external relations, and funding, you'll increase your chances of having success. So these are my suggestions. I say my humble suggestions because I think at the end of the day, Alaska has to figure out what Alaska wants to do. But I think what needs to happen first is we need to scope out what Alaska needs. What are the most important issues, whether it's OCS, whether it's transportation, whether it's Arctic issues, all those things are important, whether it's mining, conservation, they need to be focused. And then we need to look at what the existing mechanisms are that we have in place. There are a lot of them, and there are a lot of processes. I mean, Alaska's lucky in some ways that it has a good record, a good history of working together well. And it doesn't have other states. If you look at the Gulf, they've got five states there. Each state has four other states they need to coordinate with in addition to the federal government. So Alaska is in a good position. And maybe, just maybe, we'll be able to deal with whatever's most important to Alaska with these existing mechanisms. If not, well, then we look and see how what's being proposed now or something else might be the most appropriate thing to deal with these and to address these. I think it would be a mistake if Alaska turned its back completely on what the federal government's doing, because there's a risk there that the federal government, first of all, I think has decided they're going to move forward no matter what. And if Alaska ignores it or doesn't do anything, then there's a risk that the federal government will do something that either isn't in Alaska's interest or we have a missed opportunity, clearly, to get something done that's meaningful. So I would say to keep a wary eye and to on what's going on. But I think maybe most important, and that's my final bullet, is maybe what Alaska needs is its own ocean policy. Maybe Alaska should say, look, we're going to be a leader. People always laud California and other states for what they do in ocean and coastal management. Maybe Alaska needs to develop a document. It doesn't need to take 2 or 3 years. It could be something that was done in a couple of months. There's enough experts here in the state. It could be a couple of meetings. A document could be developed that then has buy-in from the different groups here that says, look, this is what's most important to Alaska. These are our goals. These are our priorities. And with that, you're in a really strong position to go negotiate with the federal government and say, okay, if you want to coordinate, let's coordinate around these issues. Let's do it in a way. And then you can decide what the scope is, what the geographic scope is, where you want to focus first, maybe just in the Arctic, maybe in certain parts, and leave the existing mechanisms that we have, like the fish councils, to do the business that they're good at doing. And at the end of the day, I think that's something that Alaska would put Alaska in the place that it deserves to be in. A lot of people on the East Coast and in Washington actually don't know that much about it. I mean, I've been to Alaska once before during the Ocean Commission hearings back in 2002 with Ed Rasmussen and others, and got to see a little bit of the beauty of the state. But a lot of people don't make it here, and a lot of people don't understand how things work here. And so I think this is an opportunity for Alaska to demonstrate that it is, you know, the largest coastal state, that it does have a handle on how to balance conservation and development, and you can't have the federal government won't be in a position to complain and say Alaska's not doing anything. Alaska's taking a leading role and is deciding what's best for itself. So with that, I thank you. I'd be happy to take any questions and. That's it. I'm willing to answer questions if anyone has one. If not, if I was absolutely clear and I've answered all your questions, that's great too. Yes, sir. Oh, we're getting a microphone. I guess you're second, sir.
Okay. Thanks for the interesting presentation. And my question is, what is the system of education in Abu Dhabi like? If you could talk about it a little bit.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
The system of education in Abu Dhabi, what is it like?
The system of education.
Yeah.
Next to defense, education and health, I think, are the most important issues that they're concerned with. Education. To support amortization, to support, you know, this capacity building in the state is very important. They have a wonderful system of schools there, whether they're public schools or private schools. I found the private school offerings there truly amazing. We had American schools, we had international baccalaureate schools. I was on the board of one of the schools there, and you had teachers from all over the world. You had really diverse communities of students. And there's a lot of money put into education. They have a number of universities there, and interestingly, there are more women in college now than there are men, which is a great sign, I think. It's showing that there's a change in culture, there's a change in traditional roles, and they might say that's not the case. Women always had the opportunity, but it's more visible now. You see more women getting into leadership roles. You see more women getting educated. A lot of students are going overseas, and a lot of them get their education paid. I know a number of them that, as long as they kept their grades up, they were on full scholarships going wherever they wanted to go. So I think there's a real interest in education, and there's a lot of advisors from abroad, from the U.S. and elsewhere, that are advising their Ministry of Education on how to improve the system further. So. I think the question was how affordable is education there for middle-class families. I didn't look at what the tuition rates were at university. I mean, private schools were comparable to what private schools were here, and public schools were, of course, free. So you see a similar system to what we might see here. But I don't know about the university rates right now. So. Mm-hmm. You're welcome. I think this gentleman right here was next.
Thank you very much. It'll take me quite a while to absorb everything you said. I have two questions. They only give me the mic once, so I have to fit in two. My first one is, could you, as your description, you had some wonderful pictures of the Gulf there with wildlife jumping out of it, and then you said in the next breath that the salinization had soared, the heat there, the and heavens only knows what's coming off all the tankers and other ships going in and out. So part of my question is, What is going on with respect to fisheries life in the Gulf? The question I'm more interested in personally is your discussion near the end of your talk about having an Alaska Oceans policy, and you described as you develop it, takes 3 months, you got it. My limited experience in government tells me that you do something like that and it sits on a shelf and gathers dust at the university and other places. So I'm wondering what you think about from implementation there out and a couple of the, you're probably aware that Alaska already has an Arctic policy board, and I'm wondering how, you know, and then there's the North Pacific Fisheries Commission you refer to, how you don't end up in a jungle of fighting over who sits on this or who helps to prepare it.
Okay, thank you for the questions. Let me just briefly go to fisheries. You're correct, it's a very hostile environment for fish to grow up in. Not a very nice neighborhood, if you will, with the water quality. But they're able to. The species that have survived have done so and have thrived. They've had to take steps to curb their capacity, their effort. They banned or outlawed certain types of gear, including larger factory boats. So the only types of commercial boats that fish are there two kinds. One is a sort of wooden dhow, and another one is a sort of fiberglass boat. They use either fixed gear or they troll. They have seasons, and they still have too much capacity. And so, you know, I was working with them to come up with some strategies to deal with the politics of that, because you have, you know, you're trying to promote your cultural background, and fishing is very important there to some of these families and tribal communities, as it is to Native Alaskan communities and others here in Alaska. So, you know, it's not as rich and diverse as the Indian Ocean. If you just go outside the Straits of Hormuz to Oman, their marine environment with the Indian Ocean is much more vibrant, coral reefs and fisheries. So a lot of seafood gets imported as well from Oman and other areas. But they do have wonderful species. They do have wonderful diversity. And they have, in fact, some areas they have. I had a picture earlier. I will go up here and show you a logo. It's here. It's just, there it is. Up on the right there, it says Butina. That is some islands offshore, very close to, remember, everything's offshore oil and gas, and more than half of Abu Dhabi's oil reserves are offshore. And this area has been protected. It is truly amazing. There are sea turtles and dugong. Dugong is a cousin of the manatee that we have in Florida. And the largest population of dugong in the world is in the Great Barrier Reef. And the second largest population is here. And it's quite amazing that in this hostile environment, coral reefs are thriving. You know, we're worried about coral bleaching in other parts of the world with ocean temperatures rising in certain areas. And here you have temperatures getting up into the 90s, and these corals are able to survive. So this is a pretty interesting, special place, and there's a competition going on right now called the New Seven Wonders of Nature. And they're in the top 28 right now, and this little place is there among some pretty big company, including the Grand Canyon and the Amazon and the Great Barrier Reef and places like that. And so there are some nuggets, some interesting places there. And of course, they're trying to protect it. There are anti-dumping laws. There are ballast water regulations. There's a lot of things that need to happen to, you know, not worsen the situation. The desalination brine being dumped in is still an issue. And I think they're going to need to deal with that sooner rather than later. There's conflicting science on the impact it's really having. But if you're, you know, if normal ocean water is 35 parts per thousand salinity, and this is somewhere between 40 and 60, you know, it makes it all that more difficult for marine life to thrive. As to your second question, you're right. When the Ocean Commission report came out, you know, all throughout the process, there was a concern that this not end up being, I think probably every commission does this, we don't want our report to end up on a shelf. You know, we want everyone to implement it. Well, you know, I would say if Alaska was just doing this as an exercise to, you know, of good government or something, there's always that risk. But you have a situation now where there are a number of issues. I mean, I'm reading in the paper, there's a number of issues going on every day that Alaska feels aren't being addressed appropriately. You have the federal government knocking on the door saying, we want to do regional governance and we want you to participate. I would guess if you went through this process, and I mean, I used a couple months as a round number. What my point is it doesn't need to take as long as an ocean commission to come up with a sound policy statement for Alaska. I would guess if I was a betting man that if something like that was put together, it wouldn't be sitting on a shelf, because I think based on what I've heard the governor talk about in his State of the State speech and what state officials were talking about when I was in Juneau yesterday, some of the commissioners, I think there's a lot of important issues in Alaska and a lot of issues that aren't being dealt with appropriately. And so if Alaska puts those down in a way that everyone buys into, I think there's a great chance that a document like that, no matter how small or large it is, I'm not proscribing how big this needs to be. This could be one piece of paper. You know, it's really up to how you can summarize, how you can put on paper and have something to go talk to the federal government about what's most important to Alaska. And, you know, it's not going to be easy. I mean, it's not going to be easy to deal with all these existing bodies. Sure, you have a North Pacific Council. You have other bodies. You have an Arctic policy. But these things just need to be taken into consideration. The problem is now that we have all these different things, and there's gaps and there's things not getting done. So, you know, I would put the question to you. I mean, if we highlight the things that we want to do, you know, and they're not getting done, why aren't they getting done? Well, let's look at what the existing mechanisms are. If they're not doing their job, well, that's one thing. If they're incapable of doing their job, then, you know, what can we do about that? So I think this is something that, again, I wouldn't suggest people from outside doing this for you. I think Alaska can do it. There's enough good people here to do this and come up with something that says, what is Alaska? What do we care about?
Yeah, I might ask, is any of the free education and possibly some of the medical care available to any of the 90% of the population that are non-citizens?
In the Abu Dhabi and the UAE?
Yeah.
Yeah. yes. Education would be available to anyone living there. We could send our kids to public schools, but there's a language issue for us, certainly, because most of the schools, the public schools, teach in Arabic. So when I say the rest of the population, most of the folks from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, they come by themselves. Their families stay at home. And in fact, when you see this, it's quite moving to see how split apart families are for economic reasons. They don't make a lot of money there. I mean, your average sort of laborer will make anywhere between $200 and $300 a month, U.S. dollars, and they get their housing paid for. They live in very meager sort of accommodations, usually, I want to say these sort of container-type housing situations. They have food provided, and it's mandatory to provide health care. So what happens is... If I'm a company or if I'm an employer, I need to provide my people with some type of housing allowance. It doesn't say I have to provide all their housing allowance, but I provide them with housing allowance. And if I have domestic help, then they would stay with us. I provide their housing. I'm required to provide health insurance, and I provide some food as well. So there's no one that doesn't have health insurance there. But I have to say, I provided health insurance. We had domestic help too, like most families there. And you know, the health insurance for our domestic person was about $180 a year. That's what I paid. And she could go to the doctor whenever she wanted to go to the hospital, and you know, and medicine was very cheap. I mean, even if you didn't have insurance, I mean, I had a different policy, there were no copays, there was no nothing. And so even if you paid for the medicine, I mean, what we would pay here, there, the same brands, they were almost nothing. I mean, you'd be paying $2-3 for a prescription, you know, instead of here, you know, you're paying a $10 or $20 copay in many cases, or not having any coverage at all and having to pay the full amount of the medication. So healthcare is very important there. That said, I would put that caveat that those with the means oftentimes will travel if they have serious illness. So it's not unusual for Emiratis or other nationals to decide that if they have, you know, a serious illness or a serious situation, that they'll travel to Europe or travel to the U.S. And we've seen that before. Rulers, you know, those are the ones we find out about, whether the King of Jordan decides to get cancer treatment in the U.S. or whether someone else has some other issues and they fly there because they have the means to do so. But the treatment there was quite good. We have Western doctors. The Cleveland Clinic is there. There were a lot of really good Western doctors there working, and so I thought the healthcare was great. And I don't know if I answered your question, but hopefully, sir.
The situation here is clearly one which is unsustainable over the long term. From a societal point of view, 15% of citizens, and the rest are something less than that. Mm-hmm. From an environmentalist point of view, the same thing, issue being desalinization. Do you see any concern or any thought being given in the really long term? And I'm meaning sort of 30 to 50 years down the road, of what Abu Dhabi wants to be then?
Well, they have a master plan that they've put into place called 2030, that lays out what geographically the Emirate is, what Abu Dhabi is going to look like. They've done it for the Western region. They're doing it for the interior. There are some big environmental questions, and you know, I've painted a picture that's very positive, but it doesn't go without the challenges. I think in terms of society, There have been some tensions with the labor force in the past. These people live very separate. They live very simple lives. There are, you know, human rights concerns that are raised all the time. You don't see the crime that we see sometimes. Now, you know, there may not be a lot of crime in Alaska or in Anchorage, but, you know, I come from the East Coast where, you know, in big cities, you try not to go out at night oftentimes. And there I felt safe about my family walking out. I mean, I have two daughters and my wife, and I felt absolutely certain that nothing was going to happen to them because no one would dare touch them for fear of the repercussions. But that's not the same case for some of the, you know, those poor groups of people that are living a terrible existence. They really don't want to be there, but economically they have to be, and so they are you know, disadvantaged. There is no real opportunity to integrate over time, and that's something that we as Westerners have noticed as well. A path to nationalization, to become a national there, if anybody would want to, is very, very difficult. I know many sort of Arabs, not from the Gulf, but Syrians, Lebanese, Egyptians, Jordanians, educated people, you know, PhDs, engineers, master's degrees, that have been doing the managing, doing the hard work, the technical work for Abu Dhabi and for the Emirates. And some of them were born there. Some of them have lived their entire life. They're still, as you say, you know, something less than, they get paid less. I mean, there's a discrepancy in terms of pay. If you're a national, you get, your extras are more, and you get more housing, you get more this, that, and the other thing. And, you know, if you're the person who's, the ruler there, you might say in the first instance, well, this was all supposed to be to take care of our people. I'm trying to create a better world for my people. And these other people are getting paid pretty good, you know. So, it's something that can be debated. The challenge is that it's very difficult to debate things in that society because of this sort of ruler mentality. I mean, no one criticizes the rulers. You don't see criticisms in the paper. You don't see, you don't see criticisms of society. There are always suggestions to improve how things are being done. But I think that's, you know, are they thinking of the long term? I think they are. Are they thinking of it like we are? Probably not. They realize that they're at a disadvantage. They have a very small population. They're trying to do things that they can't really do with that population. And so they're reliant, and probably they don't want to be, but they don't have any choice at the moment. You see turnover. You see people that leave because they don't feel, you know. I mean, I have to say, we enjoyed our time there. It was wonderful. But uh, we we knew that we weren't going to be nationals. We knew it's very difficult to interact as well. And so, you know, it's difficult to become a member of what you might say society. If you move to Alaska, you probably would find Alaskan friends, people that have been here your whole life, very quickly. If you become a part of society, no matter where you're from, there, people tend to stay more isolated, locals amongst themselves. And you see them at work, everyone's polite. There are opportunities to interact, but it's very difficult to become close friends, and it's very difficult to become, you know, to get invited over to somebody's house, for example. I, in 2 years, was never invited to someone's house. I was invited to an Omani's house, a colleague, and that's, you know, they're right next door, but they have a very different culture, and in some ways I found a more open culture. But each one of the cultures in the region, in the Middle East, was very different, and you know, people go there for a reason. They go there to make money. They go there because it's an economic opportunity, and yeah, they might like it to be better, but you know, it is the way it is right now, and I should say it's in some ways better than other countries in the region, and that's maybe no excuse, but you know, they're moving at a pace that is comfortable for them, and so I'm curious to see how these things, how things develop over the next 10 to 20 years, and you know, if we have an opportunity to talk again, maybe I'll have a different opinion. So.
Thank you very, very much for an enlightful presentation. And the Alaska World Affairs Council hopes that you return. And so we have a book for you and your daughters with some highlights of Alaska, some pictures, and hope that you come back.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. Our next program will be next week here at the Hilton on the top floor on the 28th, where we will host Jennifer Lowton, the Canadian consul, and she'll be speaking to us on Canada's Arctic foreign policy. So please RSVP to this event, and the doors will open at 11:30, program starting at noon. Thank you.